You're listening to Fuller Curated, a podcast of the best conversations happening at Fuller.
I'm Jason Sexton, and this presentation is titled Borders, Citizenship in California. It's part of the 2020 Missiology Lectures at Fuller Theological Seminary and a conference entitled Migration, Transnationalism, and Faith in Missiological Perspective, Los Angeles as a Global Crossroads. Malcolm Margolin, founder of one of California's most important independent publishing houses, Heyday Books, is reckoned that California borders are as arbitrary as they come. Regarding their origin, he states, in 1849, a bunch of alcoholics sitting around a table in Monterey drew some lines around a map through places that they'd never been and created this thing called California, and we've been stuck with it ever since. It's not real. It's not real. In no way does it conform to geography, culture, or anything else in the real world. Now, while the very mention of California creates a bona fide tension between the real and the imagined, it's true that the borders of California as a sociopolitical entity, admitted as the 31st State of the Union on September 9th, 1850, are very real. Inebriated as the Monterey Commission architects may have been, they knew they had to present something relatively manageable, which California had been anything but during the preceding century. In the Spanish colonial period, California actually consisted of two provinces, Baja California, present-day Baja, Mexico, and Alta California, present-day California. The mission system established by the Franciscans during this time, which ran from Mission San Diego de Alcala to Mission San Francisco Solano in Sonoma, constituted the social spine of the current state. The place transitioned from Spanish rule to becoming a relatively unstable Mexican province from 1821 to 1846. During its Mexican period, California became both more Pacific-oriented and foreigner-settled, though, after which the Mexican-American War from 1846 to 1848 allowed the Americans to occupy it. After several battles took place late 1846, during the weeks and months that drew an end to Mexico's grip on California, Los Angeles was the site where U.S. Captain John C. Fremont received terms of surrender from Mexican Governor Pio Pico's officers. The surrender was made official January 13, 1847, in what became known as the Treaty of Cahuenga, signed at the Cahuenga Pass Rancho, securing the end of the Mexican Californios' armed resistance in Alta, California. It took another year for the war to fully end with the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in Mexico City on February 2, 1848, signed just 9 days after James Marshall found gold on the American River at Coloma, Northern California, when David Kippen says Mexico was the richest country in the world and didn't know it. A leaky and informal relationship remained between countries, with the 1849 California Constitution securing Spanish and English as official languages, lasting until 1986, and restricting the right to vote to every white male citizen of the United States and every white male citizen of Mexico who elected to become a citizen of the United States and was at least 21 years old. The California border shared with Mexico came about relatively simply. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo gives the specifics. Upper Alta and lower Baja California were to be divided, consisting of a straight line drawn from the middle of the Rio Gila, where it unites with the Colorado, to a point on the coast, straight across, of the Pacific Ocean, distant one marine league due south of the southernmost point of the port of San Diego. In doing this, the U.S. secured San Diego. Mexico kept Baja. On the north, California borders demarcate from Oregon. along the 42nd parallel, since California is not Oregon. And then with California's southeasternmost border running straight up the Colorado River, the California border designated by the 1849 Monterey Commission basically drew a line in the sand. Going from where the 35th parallel intersects with the Colorado River to where the 39th and 120th parallels meet right in the center of Lake Tahoe, at which point the 120th parallel shoots up to the 42nd, Oregon, including the Sierra within its boundaries. Now, the state's borders are straightforward today. The cities are a different situation. This is fine, except for how much these change, both historically and ongoingly. With more inclusive flair, the late California historian Kevin Starr would often close out the prefaces of his books by identifying his location as Los Angeles, Sacramento, and San Francisco. About this tri-city dwelling, which disrupts any narrative of a self-contained city, not to mention a city's dependence on its hinterlands, Kevin Starr would often note the appropriateness of the triangulation, since he claimed he lived in a city called California. Disrupting narratives is what California does. It's not so much a place that people pass through, although they do, as it is one they locate as a destination point, or a point of termination, a terminus cupiditatis, terminus of desire. And here is often where it just so happens that eager seekers often never arrive at their desired destination and often never find what they're looking for. They often find other things, whether they want to see them or not. We consider Los Angeles as an Asian place. In fact, it's the Asian American capital of the United States, with some 1.5 million strong and counting. This is not only what the data reveals today, but was often the historical experiences of travelers headed west, only to find that they had arrived at the edge of the East, where worlds collide. Or else they find a place on fire. In her reflections on the writings of Nathaniel West, the 1965 Watts riots, and the violence and unpredictability of the Santa Ana winds, the writer Joan Didion described the city burning as Los Angeles' deepest image, accentuating the impermanence and unreliability of life in LA. While we can certainly acknowledge that LA consumes, LA also endures. A real city. After the fire, rain, floods, and earthquakes, Los Angeles buds and blooms. As with the vast array of native plants in our region, from the coastal golden bush and bush sunflower to the seacliff buckwheat, California aster, and with the sweet fragrance of a variety of sages, to the fuchsia flowering gooseberry, to the California sagebrush, LA blooms year-round in this semi-arid climate, awakening us each morning to the newness of this fragrant and delicate coastal basin. LA will bloom again and again, adopting and integrating even foreign flora and fauna, unless we overdraw the richness of its resources, turning it barren through exploitation, pollution, and unsustainable practices that wreck our environment and abuse those seeking to make life here for themselves and their families. Yet even amidst the exploitation and ongoing problems that make LA seem like a primitive city, the globe's communities take up residence here, bringing with them the world's rich resources, rich traditions, knowledge, and practices. And by drawing from all these sources in robust inclusivity, Los Angeles can continue to be a place of habitation for the world. LA's truest image, then, is not about burning. It's about life and love and hope. A dynamic movement, ever-changing and expanding. It's about making space for more life to be here against all odds. Los Angeles, then, is not one place, but many places, comprised of 88 incorporated cities, all interconnected, including the 76 unincorporated ones. 4,083 square miles with over 10 million people, Los Angeles is California's most populous city, cutting the state's northern and southern populations in half at Wilshire Boulevard. And it's the second largest city in the United States. It's the city of the future with little space to linger in the past. It engenders equal senses of dislocation, however, and disorientation amid the recycle and remake, taking the present as a work in progress, or more precisely, Linnell George says, a launching pad. Like California, the state in which it sits, Los Angeles belongs to the world, to everyone, where everyone can find representation here. LA's often morphed and mangled dwellers find this with their far-flung identity markers, derived from wherever they came, with their own nostalgic myths animating their daily mannerisms upon this supposed fresh canvas, where things can change rapidly in the uniqueness of LA's penetrating light and golden hour shadows. Amid the attempts to enhance and appropriate these cultures, the projections are often amplified and rarely enhanced. They eventually just equalize under the sun. The sun has been here for a long time, shining like it does in no other place. It's the main attraction. It gives the place life. It attracted natives long ago, and today LA County is the home to the largest native population, more than any other county in the U.S. Los Angeles is also the world's second largest Mexican city and contains enormous populations of citizens of countries around the world. As the California cultural epicenter, it's a place of becoming, where one cannot easily remain the same here. Choosing a static existence indefinitely, it just doesn't work. Things change here, and people do. And in this sense, LA reflects a central feature of the Imago Dei, pointing out that we can be something better. There's an Odyssey spirit here. It's more than a pilgrimage. It is that, but more like a promise of space that can never be had in the ways that it was promised. As it was with the early hucksters who hoodwinked the careless newcomers when they advertised land as having water privileges, only to discover that these plots were land underwater or in dry creeks, and land described as possessing scenic attractions consists of mountains and chasms. The tricksters and liars remain, but before we consider what Los Angeles holds forth and how this might be grappled with theologically, let's not move on too quickly from the fact that once upon a time, this wasn't Los Angeles at all, nor was it La Ciudad de Nuestra Señora de Los Angeles de Porciúncula. The land we occupy is Tongva land. Although they wouldn't have called themselves that. Later, they were called Gabrielinos because of their close association with the mission San Gabriel, although they wouldn't have called themselves that either. These early natives were a people of material wealth and cultural sophistication who inhabited a vast tract of some of the most fertile and productive land in California. Before European contact, there were some 5,000 people living in 50 to 100 towns and settlements on the mainland and on the Southern Channel Islands. The land they inhabited stretched from Topanga Canyon in the northwest to the base of Mount Wilson in the north, just below Pasadena, to San Bernardino in the east, and then to the Aliso Creek vicinity near El Toro Road in the southeast, which is south of Irvine, encompassing more than 2,500 square miles. Never mind current county markers, the people who dwelt here were deeply connected to the land and to the other inhabitants with whom they lived here. The fish and the waterfowl in the marshland, the dolphin at sea. Their exceptional maritime abilities allowed them to be semi-sedentary. They knew the blue jay, the rabbit, squirrel, deer, coyote, and the occasional mountain lion. They knew the rivers, every hole in the earth, and the insects. They knew the trees, the oak from which they'd gather the abundance of acorns used for their meals. And they knew the bushes and the berries, the rocks, the wind and fire, the canyons and footpaths, the sunrise and sunsets, the tides and seasons. And the earth spoke to them, and they listened with a reciprocal self-understanding that marked the moral universe that they knew, in which their morality was interwoven with geography, and they were taught who they were by where they dwelt. And then there was a theft. It wasn't a stealing of bodies, as with a different part of this nation's history, but the mission labor system brought a harsh, slave-like existence that was at least semi-captive, a communal form of forced labor, or a form of slavery without the actual sale of an individual. Amid much debate about the subject, Kerry McWilliams concluded that the entire Franciscan missionary enterprise in California's coastal regional missions was tantamount to, quote, Nazis operating concentration camps, which throughout the entire state during the colonial missions period saw the total California Indian population fall from some 300,000 people to 150,000 people, cut in half in about 70 years, many dying at or nearby the missions. After this, of course, a systematic extermination took place from 1846 to 1870, fueled by the lust of the wealth in the Northern California Gold Rush, which reduced the total population from 150,000 now down to about 30,000 in about 25 years. By 1880, the California census record gives the total native population at 16,277. The indigenous people in California who believed they came from the earth were deemed primitive. Gente sin razón. As such, they carried values not seen as worthy of being adopted or adapted for the future of what California was to be. In his account of Catholicism in America, Kevin Starr, himself a Catholic historian, noted that in spite of different intentions, they had different intentions, some did, in the best of cases, Spain's colonizing efforts included deliberate acts of warfare, rapine, and massacre, and led to the destabilization of local cultures. But what were those different intentions that he mentions? He cites the case of the Jesuit priest Eusebio Kino, who envisioned California this way in the first decade of the 18th century, on Kevin Starr's terms. With the doctrine of the incarnation forming the foundation of Kino's spirituality and evangelization, he hence perceived humans as upgraded beyond measure by the incarnation and sustained in that identity by the risen Christ. This sensibility, this sense of the world transformed while remaining knowable on its own terms. The world, that is, this world, transformed and remaining knowable on its own terms. Christianity, then, in light of this vision, didn't necessitate the colonialist project of subjugation, destabilization, and destruction that was brought about by stealing, but that is, in fact, what happened. It was the destruction of place and place-centered identities that in turn gave rise to racial identities. It all happened with stealing, an act of seizing and removing bodies from the free engagement and dwelling with the land in which their lives were storied and intricately interwoven. Now these bodies would inhabit restricted space. Their bodies could no longer engage with the land as they once had, in the place where they had once found their full lives, in the earth. No more is the world seen as communicative and animate. It's now reduced to silence and subjugated. Where they once could hear themselves in the land and the land in them, they were now displaced in what Willie James Jennings calls the geographical wound, a wound caused by foreigners coming in and to assert and insist they can see God's creation better than the earlier dwellers could. I draw a lot of this thinking from Jennings' work, which notes that this kind of supersessionism that signaled a kind of eschatological fulfillment that finds its end in a vision of land ownership, that's what's happening, and it finds itself in the destruction of place and place-centered identities that then enabled the formation of private property. Now, this background explains many things today, among which is why it's so wonderful to recreate outdoors for those who do. Once land had become private property, people removed from place, we found new ways to re-engage the land with outdoor sports and camping and desert concerts and all sorts of new ways to connect with the earth and with the sun and to be outdoors once again, to be near the land and the dirt and water and to try to find ourselves again there. And the violations continued. in a place perhaps as ongoingly contestable as its sprawl of diverse communities stretched out and its individual municipalities, none of which have any obvious and hard borders. This is because, other than what we see in the vast distinctions between the caste classes here, with their walled and gated communities and pristine lawns, day laborer presence, and astoundingly impressive neighborhoods fortified by jaded security guards and shifty sheriffs, and well endowed by the people who have made these places their own. Aside from these, Los Angeles is borderless. And while everything under the sun arguably belongs here, do these grand distinctions belong here? And do borders? Borders have an interesting history in the occupied land of Los Angeles. Incorporating the earliest game trails from millennia ago, a privately funded Spanish grid, and the setup of the pueblos, La Plaza as the city center, land outside the pueblo was divided by roads marking the boundaries of different ranchos. Adopted under Spanish and Mexico rule, the laws of the Indies meant that Los Angeles was entitled to 4 square leagues. It's about 27 square miles, and they would be held by the pueblo in common trust. So the law. Although when Fremont marched into the city, its limits had not been mapped, which in turn meant that the American grip on the city would be so much stronger as the land was parceled out for the new settlers and for real estate spectators. Much of the survey lines that were conceived by early planners of Los Angeles were transformed into actual streets during the 1880s land boom, with satellite towns like Pasadena and Santa Monica springing up from their erstwhile rancho lands, with then various grids and major streets sprawling out through the ranchos. As streets and several grids were imposed and then superimposed on the previous ones, meaning that Los Angeles city and hinterlands would be an ongoing conversation related to what already was and what could be. Extending city services like gas, electricity, and stolen water to wherever it could be was the key to the expansion, especially later amid post-war white flight, giving way then to endless suburbia and what the city might be in its sputtering cascade back into its center through gentrification, and then back out again in an ongoing ebb and flow endemic to the constant movement that Los Angeles elicits. And the city and county have grown with an ever-insatiable hunger and with an ever-flowing dynamic of rapid change that my colleague, the historian William Devereaux, terms a juggernaut that has not slowed down, nor will it, even with the various limits, be they environmental or equity or access or healthcare. These various limits will eventually produce their own momentum. But with the historical velocity a given for this town, ensuing and ongoing challenges must be met by creative and imaginative coalitions that strike as unconventional a chord as the city's own existence is. It's difficult to think, however, that even the most bold and outrageous coalitions stepping up to handle and steer the gargantuan creature of Los Angeles will be composed of anything but those most interested in protecting what they already have, perhaps creating even new classes amidst the dynamic movement. Distinctions have always been present within LA, privateered and often happenstanced, even as they are now amid the municipalities and a million plus people living in the unincorporated areas, often changing and turning over. The city was never one thing, whether juxtaposed with the mission of San Gabriel or Riverside, which is certainly not Los Angeles, or El Monte or something else. While all of this complexifies questions about LA's borders, I believe, there's no question that we certainly have barriers. Efforts to place real roots in Los Angeles are difficult, perhaps pointing to a kind of semi-nomadic effort that David Ulan exerts with his commitment to walking the city in order to stay rooted here, marking his place, he does, as he walks around, existentialist style, as a way for me to meander my universe into being, he says. We have historical barriers, though, even to this kind of privileged and pedestrian residing, subject to police state surveillance. Ray Bradbury sketched the situation in his 1951 short story, The Pedestrian, which reveals terrors that are only exacerbated against people of color especially against LA's Black and Latino residents, with removal logic manifest in unwritten racial and land covenants historically, and gated housing communities fortified by the wealth of their residents who got theirs, ahead of whatever the next wave of immigrants and refugees would be. In this way, borders, as well as barriers, operate with the same kind of logic of removal and exclusion that's manifest in eugenic practices, in mass incarceration, and in a host of violent practices that Gloria Anzaldúa describes in an early draft of her poem, Del Otro Lado, written in response to her experience visiting Borderfield State Park in San Diego in 1983. On February 2, 1848, a hatchet comes crashing down, severing her body, severing the land. She bleeds. The blood becomes a river, El Rio Grande. They build a fence across her body, Mexico, a wall called El Tratado de Guadalupe Hidalgo. Thousands are sacrificed to that barbed wall. While offering a British perspective to the issue of borders, Luke Bretherton argues that a sense of place and the existence of borders resists the homogenizing collectivism and abstraction of cosmopolitan egalitarianism, whether liberal, capitalist, or communist, that would make everyone the same and thereby eradicate the possibility of gift exchange. Such a perspective, however provisional, and even whilst recognizing that all our human constructions of place are under judgment, does not adequately account for the history of social relations within places like Los Angeles and the invasive dismembering violence of the action of the carceral state, whether liberal, capitalist, communist, on its residents, and the lack of due process for these residents, and how it enables a veneer of justice that leaves state actors unaccountable for ongoing official state-sanctioned injustices. With regard to the U.S. and Mexico border, geographer Michael Deer presents several reasons why border walls just won't work in the case of U.S. and Mexico. The border has long been a place of connectivity and collaboration, he argues. He argues that border walls fail miserably by encouraging other means of illegal immigration. And finally, he points out that spaces between Mexico and the U.S. form what Deer calls a whole other third nation, which is not a formal sovereign nation state, but shares characteristics of a nation, including shared identities, joint traditions, and language ties. For these reasons, Deer argues that the third nation endures. And amid the billions of dollars spent on the politics of border walls, a far greater investment could be made in the growing relations between the two countries, since the prosperity of the third nation, Deer says, quote, may yet prove to be the most effective guarantor of our national security and linchpin of a humane immigration policy. Of course, while subject to local and county laws and to laws of the state of California and the United States, while Los Angeles is many things, it is not a state. Yet it remains ongoingly contestable space. It remains that third space, embodied in the lives of its residents who come from around the world, having endured violence as often as having experienced hope. In California, borders remain ways of banishing the unwanted, whether into the noir of desert death, occupying the imagination of so many Los Angelinos who live on the edge of existence within LA's imaginary fear of the other. But indeed, the other is here, resident in our neighborhoods, working in our restaurants, hiking our trails, fishing on the piers, helping their kids through online school, and sharing our same plight in this current COVID-19 moment, although with greater vulnerability than the rest of us. Here we are. El otro lado está aquí. And the other is us, melded together in the complex structurings of our city, which, according to Karen Tei Yamashita, is the so-called, in her so-called magical realist reading of the situation in her book Tropic of Orange, finds Los Angeles expanding ever on. Not in the sense of Mike Davis's City of Quartz's ongoing expansion of the carceral state with its crude police state occupation, but actually moving. Yamashita gives us a space suspended between places, between Los Angeles and Mexico City, with all its parts and the whole and would-be residents turned and moving northward as the elasticity of time and space moves with them, dragging along with it the very Tropic of Cancer. Borders be damned. Belonging in Los Angeles doesn't necessarily translate to belonging to the whole of Los Angeles, or necessarily to any of its other parts, nor to California, nor to the United States. And in this way, there remains no guarantees here, and certainly none of citizenship. Los Angeles is a life giver. It's an affirmer and a dream weaver, but it's also a destroyer, a negator, and a death trap. All who reside in Los Angeles, to some degree, are fighting for this place, wanting a better life. Angelenos survive and endure, and those who wish to leave may do so at any time. The land will do whatever it will do, but those who wish to be here should be able to, since Los Angeles needs all the help that it can get. Yet ultimately, none of it will be enough to save Los Angeles. No borders can protect from what will one day happen with all surety, according to the biblical perspective, reckoning with the depth of ontological judgment on all things, historical, communal, and real, brought about irrefutably by divine action. The letter of the Hebrews in chapter 12 gives this to readers. If they did not escape when they refused the one who warned them on earth, how much less will we escape if we reject the one who warns from heaven? At that time, his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. This phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of what is shaken. The removal of what is shaken. That is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us give thanks by which we offer to God an acceptable worship with reverence and awe. For indeed, our God is a consuming fire. This passage, this biblical passage, grants not a realized eschatology, often coming in the empty promises of LA's frequent utopian and dystopian visions. That's often what LA offers. But this passage presents an eschatological realism where the future world is far more real and objective than the present one. The late Stanley Grenz noted that from this biblical perspective, this reality lies before rather than beneath or around us. And it is discovered through, he says, anticipation. Not entirely foreign to LA's persistent futurism, this orientation includes not only the reception of a kingdom that no earthquake can level, but also spells out one having a new kind of citizenship with enrollment in heaven, and not the one that's passing away. The one passing away, it's the one that of St. Augustine's worldly society, flowered from what he says, a selfish love. Whereas, on the other hand, the communion of saints is rooted in a love of God that is ready to trample on self. St. Augustine reasons again this way. He says that the city of man seeks the praise of men, whereas the height of glory for the other is to hear God in the witness of conscience. The former, seeming primitive and short-sighted, the kind that separates immigrant children from their parents, malpracticing existing just laws and rejecting ones that should be, distorting justice for the many while delivering heartily for a select few. The kingdom of this world is not the kingdom of our God. Los Angeles, though, keeps its rich terrain as a place of becoming, less like the epicenter of Gavin Newsom's California's nation-state talk, and more like a true region. It sees the good and the bad and the ugly from Palmdale to Pomona to Long Beach and Catalina as a region more akin to a province, which is always developing. It's much more like a province than a fixed city with anything resembling static fortified walls. The place functions best with the locals doing peacefully and justly among themselves. Augustine prefers something like this in his description of the city, that in a happier state of human relations, all kingdoms would remain small and rejoice in their neighborly concord. This is, I think, the eschatological vision where the body of Christ, through the power of the Holy Spirit, bears witness to this harmony and through its Catholicity contradicts the exclusionary logic of democratic nation states. Utopianism, then, is most certainly to be avoided with regard to how Los Angeles may function in relationship to those who dwell within it. And yet dwell they do in this fallen and penultimate era, plagued by sin. A localist LA regionalism offers, I think, the best of possibilities, though, with a focus away from our social fragmentedness and more toward a less estranged and more local emphasis on our own particular social orders, the way things are here. Such a regionalism is perhaps the best antidote to a cosmopolitanism that puts down no actual roots and thus becoming only a thin basis for, say, pragmatic or opportunistic formalized citizenship. Regionalism instead provides a tethering that enables a flourishing in the spirit of shared loyalty, which in turn requires and rewards engagement with one's particular dwelling place. This spirit of higher provincialism, in Josiah Royce's terms, enables the best kinds of freedom and flourishing that one might expect from neighbors who are building together within a culture of trust, perhaps even featuring the kind of love that Augustine refers to as inherent in the communion of saints, or the life sought after and shared by those residing in Royce's beloved community, or even amid what Ed Soja calls urban spatial causality and its effects in a city region that can manifest the unjust effects of neoliberal globalization and serve, on the other hand, as an active agent for new spatially informed social movements that are aimed at changing the world for better. Such a position to occupy, requires a persistence and a presence that abidingly resists various utopian and dystopian visions with a view toward an everyday learning and embodying of both LA's particular and generalizable features that take Angelenos of all kinds through the process of becoming more better versions of what they already are.
You're listening to Fuller Curated.
Hi, everyone. I'm Andy Smith. I'm a professor at UC Riverside, and I'm also a coordinator for Evangelicals for Justice, as well as part of the New Voices School for Liberation and Transformation and NAIPS, an Indigenous Learning Community. And I'm very pleased to be able to respond to Professor Sexton's very thought-provoking presentation. He unmasked the complicated histories that give rise to our current notions of what constitutes Los Angeles now, as well as what it could be in the future. He states, like California, Los Angeles belongs to the world, to everyone, where everyone can find representation here. LA's often morphed and mangled dwellers find this with their far-flung identity markers derived from wherever they came, with their own nostalgic myths animating their erstwhile mannerisms upon the supposed fresh canvas where things can change rapidly in the uniqueness of LA's penetrating light and golden hour showers. But beneath this, as Professor Sexton notes, this understanding of LA is based on the genocide of indigenous peoples from this land, whose genocide enables our presence and which also transforms our relationship to the land. He notes, once land had become private property with people removed from place, we found new ways to re-engage it. Outdoor sports, camping, desert concerts, and all sorts of new ways to reconnect with the earth, the sun, to be outdoors, to be once again near the land, dirt, and water, to try to find ourselves again. Sarita C. describes this as the double disavowal of colonialism. It's not just that indigenous peoples have to be wiped from the landscape, but the landscape has to be reanimated so we don't ask ourselves the question, where are the indigenous peoples? So instead of seeing Indigenous peoples, we now see outdoor sports, camping, and desert concerts. So Professor Sexton suggests that the way forward is to imagine LA not through borders or through a nation-state model, although we may wish to secede under the current shenanigans going on in the country today, but through a regional model built on relationalities between the diverse communities that represent Los Angeles. So building on his analysis, I want to explore what happens if we no longer consider this genocide to be a past act, but a continuing logic that continues to construct Los Angeles, as well as the relationships between people in Los Angeles. So with that, let me turn to our PowerPoint. I think it's important to note the distinct policies that impacted the Indigenous peoples of California, that they were in fact subjected to slavery, not just metaphorically, but they were part of a large slave trade, as well as a distinct policies of genocide. In 1850, an act was passed that allowed a white person to obtain Indian children as indentured servants for a period of time. Also, Indian vagrants could be arrested and hired out for 4 months. And the period by which Indian males and girls could be enslaved was extended to the age of 30 for males and to the age of 25 for girls in the amendments passed in 1860. And there was really nothing Native peoples could do to contest this. This then set the stage for not just a massive slave trade, but also the parents of children were often killed in order to maintain the fiction that these children were there voluntarily. So people would go to Native communities, kill the parents, and then abduct the children. In addition, during the policies of genocide, as they've affected Native people, obviously they affected all Native peoples, but in other areas of the country, for instance, we might see something like processes of removal. For instance, the Trail of Tears and the removal of Native peoples to west of the Mississippi River. When we get to California, there's no place to go. So we start to see a very direct support for just outright extermination. So Governor Peter Burnett stated that a war of extermination will continue to be waged between the races until the Indian race becomes extinct and must be expected. And in 1850, the sheriff of Mariposa County literally, quote, I pronounce the Indian outlawed, right? Everyone is permitted to kill the Indians he encounters anywhere in the county of Mariposa on the sole condition of burying them and letting the sheriff know where and how many of them he has killed. As a result of that, state legislatures actually paid over $1 million for white people to scalp Native peoples and to kill them. And that would be the equivalent of $33 million being spent today for the killing of Native peoples. All of these monies, which were then reimbursed by the federal government. So to sum, in the Chico Courant paper, it has become a question of extermination now. The man who takes a prisoner should himself be shot, right? So if you don't want to be complicit in the genocide of Indigenous peoples, you should be killed too. It is a mercy to the red devils to exterminate them and a saving of many white lives. Treaties are played out. There is only one kind of treaty that is effective, cold lead. And in Los Angeles, of what we are talking about, too long have the people of this state and Arizona suffered from these miserable no-account tribes. Wipe them out and it will be a blessing. Let there be no treaties made, but exterminate them root and branch. So, if we look at this past history, it's easy to kind of relegate this to the past, to see the states that were once owned by the Tonga people or the Gabrielina people. And we can forget that the people still exist today, that they are still here in these lands, fighting for sacred sites, fighting for water rights, fighting for their lands, that are often invisible to non-Native peoples who are struggling for visibility in addition to fighting for these rights. In addition, there are over 100 tribes in California that are federally recognized, but many more that are not. So the situation, the struggles that California Native peoples are just often not even seeing. But in addition to that, seeing This logic of genocide also has a tendency to construct urban areas such as Los Angeles as somehow by definition no longer being indigenous, right? Urban equals the opposite of indigenous. So we don't think of Los Angeles as being indigenous land. And here, I think Professor Sexton speaks to these ramifications around the privatization of land. When it becomes colonized, we see it as a commodity rather than through an indigenous lens where we might see land as a relative. And here, Patricia Montour Angus, a Mohawk scholar, frames it this way. She says, although Aboriginal peoples maintain a close relationship with the land, it is not about control of the land. Earth is mother, and it nurtures us all. Well, given this history of genocide, it's often easy to situate Native peoples of California in the past, particularly those in the Los Angeles area, and we can forget that the Tongva and Gabrielino people are still here, and this is still their land. They are still fighting for sacred sites. They're still fighting for land and water rights. In addition, there are over 100 tribes in California that are federally recognized and many more that are not. So there's the continuing presence of indigenous peoples that we don't want to disappear because then their struggles can become invisibilized. But in addition, as Professor Sexton has noted, when we render this genocide into the past, we don't see how it is continuing to construct our relationships with each other. In particular, the logic of genocide tends to divide urban areas from indigenous lands, such that Los Angeles cannot be imagined as indigenous land. As he notes, when land becomes privatized, we see it as an object rather than as a relative. But as Patricia Montour Angus, Mohawk scholar, notes, she says, although Aboriginal peoples maintain a close relationship with the land, it is not about control of the land. Earth is mother and she nurtures us all. It is the human race that is dependent on the earth and not vice versa. Sovereignty, when defined as my right to be responsible, requires a relationship with territory and not a relationship based on control of that territory. What must be understood then is that the Aboriginal request to have our sovereignty respected is really a request to be responsible. I don't know of anywhere else in history where a group of people have had to fight so hard just to be responsible. So when we have a different relationship with land, that changes how we understand nationhood. That is, under the current kind of colonial system, when there is encroachment on indigenous lands, the only thing you can say is, it's not your land, it's our land. The question you don't get to ask is, why should anyone get to own and control a piece of land? Right? Land is something we belong to. Land does not belong to us. And I think we see similar principles in the Bible. Some peoples may be bestowed the original instructions of how to care for the land, but they do not own the land. As stated in Psalms 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. The land must not be sold permanently because the land is mine and you reside in my land as foreigners and strangers. And that's from Leviticus 25:23. So this echoes Montour Angus's argument that land is not a possession that should be a commodity that can be bought and sold by a group of peoples. This also kind of destabilizes the categories of immigrant and foreigner too, right? The very category of immigrant implies that some people own a certain land. And if you go to a land owned by somebody else, you're somehow out of place. And yet we see in Ezekiel, you are to distribute this land amongst yourselves according to the tribes of Israel. You are to allot it as an inheritance for yourself and for the aliens who have settled among you and who have children. You are to consider them as native-born Israelites. Furthermore, as we see in Leviticus, the alien who resides with you shall be to you as a citizen among you. You shall love the alien as yourself, for you were aliens in the lands of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So the very category of even immigrant and foreigner gets destabilized when we have a different sense of nationhood. Thus, if we decolonize our relationship to scripture, we might imagine a different form of nationhood. That is, when God bestows land to a group of people, it doesn't necessarily imply an exclusivist ownership of land in which those who are not part of that nation no longer belong. Rather, those people have a set of responsibilities to care for the land as instructed by God, and those who visit those lands are well served by learning what those original instructions are. But those who travel to those lands are not to be understood as outsiders, because we are always, always in relationship to each other, to the rest of creation, and to God. I think this analysis is also important because indigenous often gets described as people who never move and never travel. So if an indigenous person goes somewhere else, they have tragically lost connections to their homelands and are no longer really indigenous. Instead, as many Native Studies scholars have noted, indigenous peoples have always been traveling and that there were cities before colonization. What defines indigeneity in that sense, it's more of a verb. It's about living in a certain way of life that understands our relationality to all of creation. So if we adopt this decolonizing framework, we may then no longer position LA as once having been Tongva or Gabrielino lands, but understand them as currently Tongva and Gabrielino lands. And thus we still have a current responsibility to learn from the indigenous peoples of these lands the original instructions for how to care for it. And it is also our responsibility to see ourselves in relationship to land as something we must be responsible for. This can then build on Professor Sexton's understanding of regionalism versus nation states, but I would term it more as about being indigenous nationhood versus nation states. Currently, there tends to be the presumption that the goal of any liberation struggle is a nation state. But many indigenous peoples have argued that you can have a nation without a nation state. A nation state is one in which it is defined through exclusive control of territory. It's based on structures of domination, of violence, and hierarchy and coercion. Whereas indigenous forms of nationhood can be predicated on interrelatedness and responsibility. That's not just about caring for the members of a nation, but for all nations, and including humans and non-humans. As indigenous organizer Ingrid Wishnawatak once said, our spirituality and our responsibilities define our duties. We understand the concept of sovereignty as woven through a fabric that encompasses our spirituality and responsibility. This is a cyclical view of sovereignty, incorporating it into our traditional philosophy and view of our responsibilities. This differs greatly from the concept of Western sovereignty, which is based on absolute power. For us, absolute power is in the creator and the natural order of all living things. Our sovereignty is related to our connections to the earth and is inherent. And Lakota Hardin has described indigenous sovereignty as based on freedom for all peoples. It goes back to what I said, that if it doesn't work for one of us, it doesn't work for any of us. None of us are free unless all of us are free. We're all in this together, and we won't turn anyone away. To exemplify this concept of indigenous nationhood, can be seen in the consensus statement made by the indigenous peoples of Latin America at the 2008 World Social Forum, when they said that the goal of indigenous struggle is not simply to fight for the survival of their particular peoples, but to transform the world in general. And they said that the nation state has not worked for the last 500 years, so it's probably not going to start working now. And instead, they argued for a vision of nationhood that requires a radical reorientation toward land. All are welcome to live on the land, but we must live in a different relationship with the land. And that's why they said our goal isn't to tell everyone else to go home, whatever home might be, but rather you can be here, but you need to be different. And I realize that arguing for this can be a little bit scary in our New Age concept, where it can sound like All you need to do is watch Avatar, paint yourself blue, and you will be indigenized. But actually, I think they're arguing for a radical reorientation towards epistemology. That is, in kind of Western epistemology, I know who I am because I'm not you. Well, if that's how I understand myself, I will then create an exclusivist understanding of nationhood, like make America great again, right? America's great when other countries aren't doing so great. But if I understand myself in relationship to all others, I know who I am because of you, then the sense of nationhood that flows from that becomes inclusive rather than exclusive. My nation can only do well when other nations are also doing well. And these ideas were also present in the indigenous organizing around SB 1070 in Los Angeles, in which indigenous peoples overtook the Border Patrol office. And I should mention that they are still working around these issues to stop the border wall construction that is traversing the lands of the Tohono O'odham peoples. Anyway, during this occupation, they said, "On this day, people who are indigenous to Arizona join with migrants who are indigenous to other parts of the Western Hemisphere in demanding a return to traditional indigenous values of freedom of movement for all people. Prior to the colonization by European nations and the establishment of the European settler state known as the United States and the artificial borders it has created, indigenous peoples migrated, traveled, and traded with each other without regard to artificial black lines drawn on maps. U.S. immigration policies dehumanize and criminalize people simply because of which side of these artificial lines they were born on. White settlers whose ancestors have only been here at most for a few hundred years have imposed these policies of terror and death on immigrants whose ancestors have lived in this hemisphere for tens of thousands of years for time immemorial." And I think these distinctions also have a biblical basis. I mean, if we remember that the Bible was written by colonized peoples to colonized peoples under conditions of colonialism, it might make sense to interpret the Bible from the lens of those who are currently being colonized. And under a colonial lens, we often interpret biblical language regarding Israel as the chosen people in exclusivist terms that require support for an exclusivist nation state of Israel. But if we interpret the Bible from a decolonial lens, we might differentiate supporting the nation of Israel from the nation state of Israel. In 1 Samuel, the people asked for a king. Essentially, they asked for a nation state rather than a nation. And God tells them that when you ask for this, you're going to get a system of oppression based, a system of governance based on oppression, and that God should be the only sovereign because God is the only just sovereign. And in 1 Samuel 11 through 18, God explains, if you ask for a king, he's going to take your stuff. He's going to make your lives miserable. He's going to take everything you own and you're going to get unhappy. And I'm going to say, I told you so. But the people refuse to listen and say, no, we want a king. We want to be like all the other nations. And so God grants a king and all the things that God predicts does in fact happen. But when we look at Jesus' pronouncements in Matthew 23:8-12, we can maybe see this as a reversal of 1 Samuel when Jesus says, "But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher and you are all brothers. You do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant, for those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." So Jesus is essentially announcing an end to kingship and proclaiming the restoration of God as the only true sovereign, which then issues in a new form of governance based on principles of equality and relationality. And as many biblical scholars have noted, the early church was in fact based on these principles of equality until the church began to connect itself to empire. Thus, we can see Jesus's model of decolonial nationhood as distinct from a nation state model is very similar to indigenous systems of nationhood. And because of that, his vision is often illegible to his followers who can only imagine liberation through a nation state. And similarly today, when people articulate their visions of liberation, they often can't be understood other than through kind of a nation state form of governance. But what the Bible shows us and what indigenous people shows us is that there's another way to think about liberation. So, for instance, we often have debates about Israel, where some scholars will say we must support the nation state of Israel kind of unconditionally. Others will argue for a more supersessionist theology and say, well, because Jewish people did not accept Jesus, God does not favor Israel. But we no longer have to pit these things against each other if we start to see that a relationship with a nation does not necessarily require exclusivity, that God's relationship with Israel is manifested through God's care for all other nations. So from this perspective, God's relationship with a particular nation is most fulfilled in God's relationship to all nations. Nations are strongest when they understand themselves in radical relationality with each other. Thus, Los Angeles could be decolonized by unsettling our relationship to this land and to all the nations connected to this land. So I thank you very much for the opportunity to respond to Professor Sexton's thought-provoking work, and I look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
You have been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.